This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's recent interview with Jeffrey Tambor, who stars in the Amazon series Transparent as a transgender woman, making her transition from male to female late in life. All of the episodes for season 2 are available for binging now. Jeffrey Tambor also co-starred on the TV series Arrested Development and The Larry Sanders Show. Transparent was created by Jill Soloway and was inspired by watching her parent come out at the age of 75 as a transgender woman. In season 1 of Transparent, Tambor's character Mort started transitioning to Mara, revealed her female identity to her 3 adult children and ex-wife, and started appearing in public in women's clothes. Terry began her interview with Jeffrey Tambor by playing this clip from the first episode. In this scene, Mara's at her transgender support group and is describing how she just started testing out appearing in public wearing women's clothes.
Well, I went to Target, and I took her out, you know what I mean?
And I got into, the checkout line, and the girl at the cash register said,
I need to see some ID with that credit card of yours, and you know what that's like, right? And I just knew, I said, this is gonna not be good, this is gonna get ugly. And so she just kept looking at me. And then she said, oh. Like that, you know? And she rung up the batteries or something. That was a big victory. And I didn't, I would say, do not cry in front of this woman. Do not cry in front of this woman.
Thank you for your share, Mora. Thanks for being vulnerable with us.
One more thing. I made a commitment here last week that I was going to come out to my kids, and I didn't do it. Because it just wasn't time, you know? But I will, and it will be soon.
Yeah.
I promise you. I promise you. I promise you. They are so selfish. I don't know how it is I raised 3 people who cannot see beyond themselves.
Jeffrey Tambor, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
So did you ask for the part on Transparent, or did they come to you?
Well, I was out in Los Angeles. I live in New York. And I was out in Los Angeles to do a talk show. And when I got off the plane, there was this script. And my agents said, this is a fabulous script. You should really look at this. And I read it, and I called them back immediately. I hadn't even gotten to my hotel from the airport yet. And I said, I'm in.
Do you have any idea why they thought of you to play the part of Mora?
Actually, Jill told me that I remind her of her mappa, of her parent. And
Mappa is her word for mother, papa.
Her parent, Carrie, yes. And I think something about we have sort of our humor and our sort of dry humor and the way we, you know, we carry ourselves in the world. And I do remember the day Carrie came on the set. Actually, it was my 70th birthday. And I was so nervous. But I somehow won her approval, and she was very kind and very supportive.
Now, your character isn't glamorous and fashionable in the way that, for instance, Laverne Cox, one of the stars of Orange is mm-hmm. the New Black, is. Mm-hmm. When your character Mora dresses in more formal attire, like a long purple dress with like sequiny, spangly things all over it, I am reminded of what my parents' generation, the women of my parents' generation, used to wear to like weddings and bar mitzvahs.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, when you dress in that women's formal attire, who do you see when you look in the mirror? Do you see people that you know, relatives that you know, friends?
No, I don't. I actually see, as I said, I do see Mora. I remember when Reese Ernst and Zachary Drucker and Jill Soloway came to my hotel room when we were just preparing, and we were going to take Maura out for the first time. And I was going to meet Maura for the first time, and so we went into the to the bathroom. After a long, long talk, and we had much talk, and I was scared stiff. And we began the makeup, and I did the hair, and or they did the hair, and we went to we went out dancing at a place called the Oxwood, and I remember walking through the lobby of that hotel. My legs were just shaking, and I said to myself, never, 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 never forget this moment, because this is exactly how it is to live as Maura. And the odd thing is no one was looking at me.
So what was it like for you to feel like you passed?
I don't know if I passed. I think I got through the night.
Were people staring at you?
Not at the Oxwood and not at the hotel. That was what was very odd. I did go on another field trip where I did have that, where I went to a grocery store, and I was in the middle of the aisle. I was just like doing what if Maura went shopping, and I wanted to find out what Maura would wear and what she would buy and things like that. You know, just not to sound too actory, but that's how you research and that's how you find. And one person did stare at me in the aisle and had a somewhat of a sneer on their face. And I also said, do not forget this, because this is what it looks like to get clocked. And I don't know if they were looking at me and saying, well, that's Jeffrey Tambor, or that's a trans woman. I have no idea, but I do remember. I remember the sneer on the face, and it wasn't pretty.
Maura's in the position of having recently started appearing in public as a woman in women's clothes with a woman's wig, and sometimes she kind of passes, you know, unnoticed and just blends in, and other times people stare at her with kind of, you know, confusion or anger, hostility. And I'm wondering, like, in your own life as you, as Jeffrey Tambor, if you were ever in a similar position where people were just, based on how you looked, that you got, you know, hostile or mocking looks from people.
I have two things I can point to. But what's dangerous about me pointing them out is that I could never say that either one of them even equals what it is to be a transgender woman or a man.
Sure.
However, I do know what it is to be otherized in the community. When I was a young boy in San Francisco, I remember being sent home from a person. I was playing with a friend, and I remember the mother saying, tell Jeffrey to go home. And I said to the girl, I said, why? And she goes, my mother says that you're the people who killed Christ. And I got home. And what was the worst part of that was when I told this really getting me as I'm saying it. I remember when I told that at dinner to my parents, and I remember them looking up into each other's eyes. And I will never forget that, because it wasn't even fear. It was like, there it is. So I kind of know what that was. And also I remember I grew up, and I don't think I've ever talked about this. I grew up with a lisp. I talk like this because I had braces. And so my name is Jeff. So everyone in my school called me Cliff, unfortunately. And I'd say, no, Jeff. And so they called me Cliff. People would make fun of me because I had this lisp.
How did you lose the lisp? Was taking off the braces sufficient?
No. I went to so many people, and at San Francisco State College, I still had it. And there was a man named Dr. Joe Mitzak, who one day just said, have you ever heard your lisp? And I said, no. So he recorded it, and he said, you're saying S. And I went, oh. He said, this is how you say S. S. And I went, oh, S? And he went, that's correct. And that's what it took.
Wow.
I had to hear it.
That's so smart.
Isn't it amazing? Yes.
You've said in other interviews that your father gave you the advice, don't celebrate, they'll take it away from you. And this is the kind of advice from, you know, like long periods of suffering and persecution that Jewish people, you know, face through the centuries. But were there times in your family where it was an official celebration, it was your duty to celebrate? Like, you're not supposed to be too happy, but on these days, it's your job to be happy.
Well, my dad's thing was, we practically had don't celebrate printed on the napkins. It was serious business. But his big thing is, I would say, Dad, I'm on Broadway with George C. Scott. And he would say, shh, don't say anything. Don't tell anybody. Dad, I'm getting married. Shh, don't say nothing. Don't do anything. And that was sort of the thing. So when I get awards, there's a little agita that goes on with this, because I can hear my dad going, shh, don't say anything. Don't celebrate. So he honestly, because he was taught, don't celebrate, they'll take it away from you. And his parents were taught that, and his parents and parents, because if you did celebrate and you were visible, it could be very, very dangerous.
Right.
So part of it is just, you know, part of it is trauma, but part of it is fact.
But it doesn't exactly lead to understanding how to experience pleasure and pride and confidence.
Mm. Right. I don't know how to answer your question.
I guess it wasn't really a question. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
Was that true?
But do you want to hear a great moment, a great NPR moment?
Yeah, sure.
And it has to do exactly with what we're talking about. So when we started coming out with our show, and the reviews were just coming out for the first season, and, you know, I was very proud of it, but, you know, it could go any way. And so I'm taking my son up to his Boy Scout, Cub Scout camp, and he loves NPR, and he's 11. And all of a sudden, the NPR review comes on of Transparent. And I look in the back seat, you know, I'm looking in the rearview mirror, and the reviewer, and it was a very nice review, mentioned my name. And I looked at him, and he had this smile on his face. And I will never, never forget that moment, because I think for the first time, he knew what I did for a living.
Right.
And it was a great moment.
And you were allowed to be proud.
And I was allowed to be proud. I was. And I actually, you'll pardon the expression, caveled.
That's Yiddish for kind of like shivered with joy.
Yes, it's the opposite of don't celebrate.
Right. I think probably the first place I ever saw you, although I didn't know it was you, was on an Avis ad. And Avis Rent-A-Car had this ad campaign.
How can you possibly remember that?
Well, because, Mike. No, in looking up your work, I found this ad, and I remember these ads. There's a period when Hertz was like the number one rental car agency,
right.
And they had this ad with O.J. Simpson
right.
running through the airport to get to the Hertz counter, and the gist of the ad was Hertz for people in a hurry.
You know,
and it's like the superstar agency for people in a hurry. So Avis, that was always like the we're number two, but we try harder rent-a-car agency, they had an ad in which, like, you're this, like, person on a business trip, is what we presume, and you're very beleaguered, and you're running through the airport like O.J., and you're jumping over a velvet rope like O.J. in the airport, but you're panting, you're, like, mopping your forehead. And in this ad, an Avis representative catches up with you and says, like, you don't have to run. And you go, oh,
I remember this.
I don't have to run.
I remember.
Let's listen to it. Let's listen to it. And the first voice first we'll hear is the Avis representative, and then we'll hear Jeffrey Tambor.
Sir, what's the hurry?
Going to rent a car.
Oh, well, you don't have to run.
Gotta run.
Oh, no, if you had an Avis Wizard number, you could walk.
Walk.
Call toll-free and let our wizard system do the running. Just show a major credit card, license, sign, and get the car.
I don't have to run through airport?
Not with Avis.
I can walk through airport.
We try hard, Avis. Avis, we don't know another way.
I'm walking through airport.
Oh, my God. I don't know. I can remember it like it was yesterday. It was Newark Airport, and I was exhausted by the end of the day. Isn't that funny that you should? You know, I forgot about that.
So what effect did this Avis ad have on your career? Did it help you get anything else, other commercials or actual roles?
You have to understand, I've done about 10 to 12 years of regional theater. And then I decided to come to New York, and I had to start all over again. So I made my living doing commercials. And I did a lot because, again, there was that young husband, balding husband, sort of thing that was very attractive to advertising. And I did that for years. I made $40,000 my first year here.
But I
couldn't get arrested. I couldn't get arrested in any legitimate theater.
So one of the great roles that you played was on the Larry Sanders Show. And Larry Sanders was played by Gary Shandling. And Larry was this late night Tonight Show style host. And you played the sidekick, Hank. And your catchphrase was, you want to do it for us?
Hey now.
Yeah. And so I want to play a scene from the Larry Sanders Show in which Larry Sanders tells you that maybe it's time to drop your catchphrase, hey now. So here's my guest, Jeffrey Tambor, with Gary Shandling on the Larry Sanders Show.
You know, Hank, I was just wondering why you say that hey now thing.
What do you mean?
Well, it's just something that you used on the show, and now you're starting to use it in your personal life, and it's an affectation of some sort, isn't it? Did you ever say hey now as a kid?
No, I don't. I probably didn't.
Uh-huh.
But I said, hey.
Yeah.
And I said, now. At different times. No, I never put them together till later in life.
Uh-huh.
So, in that sense, it's part of my personality.
You know, Hank, this isn't easy for me, but would you mind not doing it on the show anymore? Because, frankly, I'll tell you the truth.
Wait a minute. Are you telling me that when you do your, you do this, that isn't the same affectation? That isn't the same as my, hey now?
There, you just said it again. And, you know, I asked you not to say it.
I can't say it off stage either?
It doesn't even exist. Use hey now in a sentence, Hank.
Hey now, that was real funny.
You know what, Hank? It's not even in the dictionary, hey now.
Okay, this is how I use hey now in a sentence, okay? You say, and of course, my sidekick, Hank.
And of course, my sidekick, Hank.
Hey now!
Hank?
That's a sentence.
No. Hank, listen. I just prefer you not do it on the show anymore, okay? I just, it gets on my nerves, it gets on the audience's nerves as well.
No, sir.
Yes, it does.
No.
Hank?
Look, you're not out there. And believe me, it's very big with the audience. No. And I'm going to tell you something else. I think it helps make the show work. It's part of our whole interplay on camera.
By interplay, you mean the times we're both awake?
Hey, now.
Just cut down on it. Could you do that, please?
There's a scene from the Larry Sanders Show with Gary Shandling and my guest, Jeffrey Tambor.
Everything, when I watched Gary Shandling, I said, whatever he's doing is what I believe in. That's what I believe comedy is. It's not pat. It's not automatic. It's not super performed. It's sort of messy and very, very funny. And he goes past the laugh to get something else. And I said, I believe in that. And I remember as I watched it saying, but I never put two and two together. And then I'm in the room and I think I did. The audition that I did for him is no different than when I did finally film it. I think I had it so tightened down that on the director's DVD, you can still see my audition for that. I do remember being so possessed in the audition that when the character of Larry started to leave and Hank didn't want him, in the audition, I took an entire sofa, picked it up and put it in the doorway. And I remember to block his exit. And I remember Gary looking over at the casting director, Francine Maisler, and giving a little bit of a nod. And I think I had the role from that moment on.
So this final question, this might be heading into territory
I kind of want to talk to you for the rest of my life.
That's so sweet. I would enjoy that too.
Yes.
So you've been sober for, I don't know, more than a decade. I don't know how many years exactly.
16. 15.
15. I'm wondering if it's liberating to be sober in the sense that, you know, an actor has to be kind of naked in a lot of ways, like you're inhabiting somebody else, but you have to feel free to go to uncomfortable places and everything and to not be, to be open to feeling things. And if you have a secret, like if you've been secretly drinking or something, that that has to kind of close you off in some way. So I would assume. So I'm wondering if it's easier to be open in a way that you must as an actor when you're sober.
Well,
even though people think it's
sober,
more freeing to, you know, to be high.
Yeah, actually, I can only speak for me. Mm-hmm. In my life, I find that in sobriety, I feel much more, and I have much more depth. I also feel, not to segue, but as being a parent of five kids, I can bring much more to my acting. And so I'm all about anything that gives you more feeling and more depth. You also feel more. And in feeling more, the waters can get rough. But so what? Let the waters be rough. I don't think if I hadn't been sober, I don't think I would have even been around for Transparent.
Right. Thank you for that.
Yeah. I think your resources are feeling. Your resources are depth. Your resources are learning. Your resources are touching and feeling. And to me, sobriety helps and aids all of that.
Jeffrey Tambor, I enjoyed our talk immensely. Thank you so much for doing this.
Me too. Thank you. Okay, so we talk every 10 years. Is that correct?
That's true. We could speed it up a little bit.
I think we're going to have to.
We're going to have to.
Jeffrey Tambor stars in the Amazon series Transparent. He was just nominated for a second Golden Globe for his performance. All of season 2's episodes are now online. Netflix has provided original hour-long dramas like House of Cards and Orange is the New Black, and half-hour comedies like The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt and Master of None. Now it takes a stab at another once-pervasive TV genre, the holiday special. It's called A Very Murray Christmas and stars Bill Murray. Our TV critic David Biancooley has a review.
A Very Murray Christmas is directed and co-written by Sofia Coppola, who also worked with Bill Murray on the movie Lost in Translation. In that film, Murray played an actor in Japan reluctantly doing a series of commercials there and not at all happy. In A Very Murray Christmas, Murray starts out in much the same mood. He's in his room at New York's Carlyle Hotel, killing time with old friend Paul Schaefer, who's noodling at the piano. Outside, a snowstorm is raging. Inside, Bill Murray is pouting and singing a Christmas song, but it's not a cheerful one.
When somebody wants you, somebody needs you, Christmas is a joy of joys. But friends, when you're lonely, you'll find that it's only a thing for little girls and little boys.
When I heard that Bill Murray was doing a Christmas special for Netflix, my first thought, I'll admit, was, why? Is that something he'd really want to do? And as it turns out, that's the way A Very Murray Christmas begins. He's playing a version of himself who's accepted a booking for a TV Christmas special live from the Cafe Carlyle. And now that the day has arrived, the scheduled guests have not because of a winter storm that stopped the city in its tracks. That's the basic premise, but it expands from there in a way that's clever and enjoyable enough not to spoil by describing it in advance. Before the one-hour special is over, though, A Very Murray Christmas does indeed find a way to make room for more than its share of special guest stars, including George Clooney, Chris Rock, and Miley Cyrus. What I do want to reveal about this special in advance is its overall tone, which, quite appropriately, takes a cue from the Charles Dickens classic A Christmas Carol. Murray, who long ago starred in the movie Scrooged, once again starts out here as a curmudgeon, but eventually finds a way to get caught up in the holiday spirit. TV holiday specials used to be all over the tube, back when there were TV tubes, and they didn't require much. A few stars, a few Christmas carols, and maybe a production number or two. That's the very formula followed by A Very Murray Christmas, but with a twist. And, most important, without irony. This isn't Bill Murray in the guise of his smug nightclub crooner from Saturday Night Live. This is Bill Murray in the guise of Bill Murray, enjoying himself with friends like musician Paul Schaefer, who first worked with Murray back in the 70s. And with George Clooney, who gets to join with Murray on a playful duet and sing the title refrain of a little ditty called Santa Claus Wants Some Lovin'.
Now mama's in the kitchen cooking, the children all fast asleep. It's time for Santa Claus to make his midnight creep.
Santa Claus wants some lovin'. Santa Claus wants some lovin'.
Yeah, I know there's something real pretty underneath the Christmas tree. But I ain't had no lovin' all week. It's beginning to worry me because
they're having fun, but they're not being sarcastic here or making fun of the holiday special itself. When Stephen Colbert did a Comedy Central holiday special, it was wonderful, but it was part homage, part satire. Bill Murray, in this special, essentially is playing it straight, even when he's clowning around, and asking his guests to do likewise. Even the comedy bits are performed at face value. And sometimes, when you might be expecting some sort of ironic subtext from a musical performance, you get full-out sincerity instead. Here's Miley Cyrus, accompanied only by Paul Schaefer at the piano, singing one of the season's most familiar standards and taking it very seriously. The surprise way this holiday special shifts and changes in both tone and setting is actually very sweet, and so is this entire special. A Very Murray Christmas is an unexpectedly tender little TV jewel from the man who built his early career on being a wisecracking cynic. If you remember the holiday specials of old with any sort of fondness, you'll like what Bill Murray is up to on Netflix this season. And even if you don't have any twinges of nostalgia for those TV specials from the 60s and 70s, or if you're too young to remember them, I suspect you'll enjoy A Very Murray Christmas anyway. I can be a pretty cynical guy myself, and even I had a good time watching it.
David Biancooley is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches television and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. He reviewed the new Netflix holiday special, A Very Murray Christmas. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with Rick Moody, author of the new book, Hotels of North America. It's told solely in the form of website hotel reviews, written by a man who shares some details about his life within his reviews and seems to be increasingly down on his luck. Sometimes he tries to skip out without paying the bill. Some of the hotels he reviews are seedy and roach-infested. It's possible that he's homeless. But he's proud to be one of the top reviewers on the website RateYourLodging.com. Rick Moody's other books include the memoir The Black Veil and the novel The Ice Storm, which was adapted into the film of the same name. Moody also writes an unusual advice column on his website in which he takes on the persona of life coach.
Rick Moody, welcome back to Fresh Air. I've picked out a passage for you to read from Hotels of North America, your new novel, and this is one of the entries, one of the reviews of one of the hotels the main character has stayed at. Would you read it for us?
I'd be happy to. The passage is called Union Station, Water Street, New London, Connecticut, May 13th to 14th, 1984. How grateful I am that you guys have named me a top reviewer on this site. You and I are people conjoined by a belief in sincerity and by a basic agreement about what that means. I'm not going to say the hairdryer in the room didn't scorch a hole in the wall if it did. That's just who I am. Say you're staying in a hotel room in Hilton Head, South Carolina, that was used shortly before you took occupancy for the filming of an adult movie. Perhaps because of the sybaritic amenities of the hotel and the appearance in the backdrop of southern vegetation, such as Spanish moss. Don't you want to know that this is the kind of hotel that allows such uses? The kind of hotel that might clean up a little bit and spray around some disinfectant? Which reminds me, I have often desired to have an infrared camera of some kind that could detail the sex stains that are surely concealed on hotel room bedspreads, which we all know are not routinely cleaned. Should we not be trying to create a national conversation on the subject of cleaning the unlaundered bedspreads of the world?
That's Rick Moody reading from his new novel, Hotels of North America. I'm so glad you raised the point about bedspreads in your book, because it's not something you think about when you're a child, but once you become an adult, you wonder what is on this bedspread. Like, they wash the sheets every day. The bedspread, the blanket, who knows when it's cleaned? Who knows what's going on that blanket? You've stayed at a lot of hotels, I imagine. Do you think about that a lot?
I do. I do think about it. I've thought about it over the years frequently. And now that I've written it down, unfortunately, I don't know if I'll ever stop. It's just there.
I know people who take their own blankets with them.
That's such a good idea. I've never thought of that, but maybe now that you mention it, that's a way to go in the future.
Were you ever tempted to write an online review of a hotel?
Yes. In fact, here's how it happened. I was trying to write a more conventional novel in sort of 2009, 2010. And believe it or not, it was meant to be about a NPR producer.
No, really?
Seriously. He was going to be the protagonist. He was near a roadside bombing in Baghdad at the end of the conflict, and he comes home to try to sort of patch it up. And I wrote 200, 250 pages of this book, and I just sort of woke up one day and I had grave reservations about my ability to use that book to say something with literature that was new. I just felt like it wasn't new. And at the same time, my wife and I were staying in Bergen, Norway, in a very, very bad hotel. Just a horrible, horrible hotel. Among its many bad features was the Friday and Saturday night house music bacchanal in the cafe, where you could hear it in your room, for until 2 a.m. And at some point, Laurel, my wife, said, "We should review this hotel." And I had never really thought of such a thing. I tended to avoid online reviews because I didn't want to encounter one that was about the books of Rick Moody. So I sort of threw them all out. But when she made the suggestion, I thought, yes, yes, I should review this hotel. So I wrote a splenetic, savage, take no prisoners review of the hotel. And I was just getting to the point of where should I post this, you know, when I had that thought. And the thought was, you know, a really crazy idea would be to try to make a novel out of these.
So did you actually post your review?
No, I put it in the novel and then I took it out because it wasn't as good as many of the other ones. But it was the starting point for the book.
You know, there's really a lot of reflection in this because the book is part memoir, you know, part this character's memoir. And we learn the story of his life in bits and pieces, or part of his life in bits and pieces through the course of the book. And in part of the book, in one passage in the book, he writes about home and the meaning of home because he kind of doesn't have one at the moment. You know, he's separated from his wife. He can't see his daughter. He's staying at these hotels. I'd like you to read that passage for us. I've asked you to abbreviate it a little bit because there won't be time to read the whole thing. But it's a beautiful passage.
Thanks. I would love to try to read it. Home, the place your enemies would wish to avoid. Home, the place your former lovers are troubled by. Home, where you can sit at the quiet table in the morning. Home, the place you sometimes hate, that you also love the second you leave it. Home, any address that causes you to tear up. Home, near the metal box that has your surname on it. Home, where almost all the postcards you have ever received have been delivered. Home, where the government of your nation believes you live. Home, where your mother or your father brought you the second you no longer lived in a hospital. Home, where you first sang whatever it is you first sang. What welcome means, this you first learned at home, along with the word home. Home is where your bedroom was in the past and is now. And home is where you sleep more days than you sleep anywhere else. Because if it were otherwise, you would renegotiate the application of the word home. Home is what you will describe in your masterpiece, either home or the leaving of home. If you say you have no home on earth, then what you mean is that there was trouble at your home. Home is where you go right before dark. Home is where you go when you are recovered. When work becomes impossible, you will long for home. It is possible that in your life you have had multiple homes, a sequence of homes, and that each of these has required a transition. For example, when you were in a car that carried you from a house where both your parents had lived together to a house where only one of your parents lived, even during that car ride, there was still an idea of home.
I would love to know what you were thinking about when you wrote that passage, because there's so many turning point events in almost anyone's life that are referred to in that passage.
I mean, I started, I think, again and again. I've quoted it before. I quoted it in a story long ago. But I think again and again of this passage in Robert Frost, Home is Where They Have to Take You In. And, you know, so true for me. I had such a sort of difficult teen period. In fact, my dad turned 80 last year, and at one point during the celebration, he turned to me and he said, "You were such a difficult teenager," and it was really true. And then in my 20s, you know, I had all these problems. I was in the psychiatric hospital for a while. I had a drinking problem, so you know, I had a long, difficult road getting to adulthood. And given that that's the case, and that there were periods of sort of aimlessness and uncertainty professionally and all that kind of stuff, I feel like now, at a stable point, when I have a family of my own, I really have appreciation for this word. It's not that home's, you know, a complex place that I'm worried about going back to. It's actually a place of refuge now. I feel that. I feel it powerfully. And I suppose that the passage came out of that.
So we've been talking about your book, Hotels of North America. And I want to talk with you now about your website, the Rick Moody website. And there's a part of your website that's a really interesting echo of your novel, because your novel is a series of online hotel and motel reviews by this online reviewer. And in the process of reviewing hotels, he's also revealing bits and pieces about his life. There's a section of your website in which you explain that you've always wanted to be a life coach, so you're going to fulfill that ambition by answering readers' questions about their lives. I'm guessing that those questions are questions that you made up?
Absolutely not.
Seriously?
I'm so happy to say that those are all real questions.
Why are you putting yourself then in the real position of answering them? People are, you know, these are really deep questions about, you know, someone whose friend is on the verge of suicide, somebody who lost, like, their sister, and their mother was bereft, and now the mother's died, too. I mean, these are really just, like, heartbreaking letters from people who want to know, like, how do I face these things in my life? Who are you to respond?
Who am I? Now, what I find interesting, Terry,
yes,
is that that life coach is a self-anointed title.
Yes.
It's not really, unlike
clinical
social worker.
There are classes in that, but I'm not sure what the licensing, if any, is like.
Yeah, it's sort of the Wild West out there for life coaches. And so I decided that I would self-declare. And I have nothing, I have absolutely nothing that would make me a great life coach, except that I too have been through a great number of travails and have emerged intact, and I have complete sympathy and compassion for my fellow sufferers on the road. So all I did was say, if you want to write me an advice question, I will be happy to try to answer it. And initially, I think I mainly attracted people with literary-related questions. You know, I have writer's block or you know, how do I get an agent or what have you. And at the outset, I sort of thought that I was like the character in Nathaniel West's Miss Lonely Hearts, which is to say, you know, a little bit tongue-in-cheek, sort of doing it because I could. But I very quickly found that people with earnest problems who really want help are people that I totally sympathize with. And even though I'm no expert, I do have some, you know, reasonably practical advice, most of which is along the lines of, you're really trying hard and you're doing a great job. And if you need someone to say to you today that your struggle is real and it's hard luck, but you're doing great, I am happy to be that person. I'm happy to be that person. So that's just what I started doing. And in fact, that has in turn generated other people who want more of the same, and I'm happy to serve. So if what little wisdom I have can be of service, then I really want to be the person who tries to help. So you Fresh Air listeners, feel free, contact me.
In response to another writer for your advice column, you write about middle age, which you're in. I mean, you're in your, mid-50s now?
Yeah.
And you write, middle age and one's own death. These are the things that are bounded on the one end by the demise of one's parents. Gazing at the dramatic extremities of this situation would cause anyone to be hesitant, but my argument is about not forgetting the great responsibility of middle age, taking care of ourselves, recognizing when we have gone beyond what the body is able to accomplish. Or put it this way, if we are to parent ourselves now the way our parents are perhaps no longer able to, the thing we should remind ourselves of at the close of each day is this: you've done enough today, and now you should rest. There will be plenty of time tomorrow to solve all of the world's problems and to make sure that all of your nearest and dearest can get through another day. That paragraph is both such a cliche and so profound at the same time. Do you know what I mean? It's so obvious and yet so true.
I mean, yes, I concur. I felt, and I always feel in the life coach letters, that my job is not to be profound in the literary sense. My job is to try to be be there for the person in question, you know? And I really felt for that guy that that repeating the tried and true would be helpful to him, in the sense that if you get caught up sometimes, especially in middle age, with looking after everybody else in a grief situation, let's say, you forget these really obvious things. And in our 20s and 30s, or this is my experience, in my 20s and 30s, I never thought about that stuff. I burned the candle at both ends. I stayed up writing, you know, into the early hours, or I stayed up and went to a club, and then I came home and wrote, and I never thought about really anybody else terribly much, unless they intruded into my imaginative space a little bit. So for me to be where I am now in my mid-50s and sort of say, hey, it's okay for you to take time to just take your pulse, slow down, and be where you are, cliche, but also so important to reiterate. And all I'm doing here in the passage is trying to find a new way to say that, so that I can refresh the idea with the language such that it might appear to be novel to those who have forgotten.
Rick Moody's new novel is called Hotels of North America. You can hear a longer version of his conversation with Terry on Fresh Air's podcast at itunes.com/freshair. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.